Chapter 29. President Wilson, Colonel House. It is impossible to speak of the many significant peace attempts of the First World War, all of them failures, without mentioning the peace negotiations of the Americans, or more precisely of Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States. Those negotiations, too, failed. But they were of a quite special nature, and they were going to change the face of the world. In the first place, they were the earliest of all the attempts, since they were begun as early as 1914, before the start of the war. Their sincerity quickly became suspect. They were fairly objective in 1914 from May to July in the first instance, then in the month of September after the great German victories in France and Prussia, and they even revealed a certain tendency to acknowledge that Wilhelm II, the Emperor of Germany, was the only one who desired peace. From 1915 to 1917 they would slightly, then strongly favor the Allies, although that was rather hypocritically camouflaged because it was imperative not to displease the American voters, who were 90% for neutrality. The secret adherence of Wilson's government to the Allies would end in the spring of 1917, with the entry of the United States into the war. The great and total evolution of the war dates from that point, when it was transformed from a European war to a world war. The paltry French-British-Russian-German quarrels would be left behind. On the one hand, the Tsarist power would collapse, and communism would take its place. On the other hand, a giant America would hurl the enormous weight of its power, untried and until then almost unknown, onto the scales of world politics. Intervention by the United States would change everything. It would give an entirely new orientation to the European war then bogged down in Flanders. It superimposed a completely new world of elemental power on the death throes of an anemic Europe, a Europe that was stupidly destroying itself as a world power. In a few decades, two giant land masses would bring to an end 2,000 years of European expansion. From 1917 on, the War of Europe was no longer anything but civil war, the world was changing forever. There is no explaining the First World War without an examination in depth of the role that the United States of America assumed between 1914 and 1918. Who at that time was the driving force in the United States? Everyone spoke of Wilson, who quickly became considered the master of humanity's destiny. On the other hand, few speak of Colonel House, a secret, almost mythical figure, who was the all-powerful mentor of President Wilson. Who was this shadowy Colonel House? Who, indeed, was Wilson? Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States, was an austere and strict Calvinist, the son, grandson, and son-in-law of Presbyterian ministers. He said his prayers on his knees morning and night throughout his life. He read the Bible every day. He wore out two or three Bibles in the course of his life. He said grace before every meal. Bullitt, President Wilson, page 36. Bullitt has left an impressive portrait of this puny fellow with the big soft mouth. He had light gray eyes and lackluster blonde hair. He was thin, pale, and weak. His eyesight was extraordinarily deficient. He was hardly out of his baby clothes when he had to wear glasses. Moreover, from infancy on he had intestinal trouble which plagued him throughout his life. He was coddled by his father, his mother, and his two older sisters, but these troubles persisted, giving him migraine headaches and stomach ailments. He was so sickly that his parents didn't send him to school. He didn't learn the alphabet until he was 9 years old and didn't know how to read until he was 11. His homely features were made still more plain by the eyeglasses riding on his prominent nose and by his astonishingly bad teeth. Although he never smoked, they were mottled with caries, so that when he smiled, brown and blue stains appeared amid flashes of gold. He had a livid complexion, with unhealthy red blotches. His legs were too short for his body, so that he looked more distinguished seated than standing. He was so poorly informed about international affairs that he couldn't tell one country from another on a map. Parsimonious, he was horrified at the cost of a cable and hesitated a long time before sending one. His only diversions were billiards and proper family reading sessions in the evening. Looked at this way, however, the portrait of Woodrow Wilson does not adhere strictly to the realities, or at least it is not complete, because throughout his career Wilson was simply a screen for others. The real master of the United States in those days, right up to the fateful Versailles Peace Conference, was not Wilson but the man who owned him outright and had made him President of the United States and partner in 1917 of the Allies in the First World War. This mentor of Wilson's was a mysterious colonel, who did not occupy any official post whatsoever. Secret, insinuating, he worked strictly behind the scenes and undercover. He was not even a colonel. His name was Edward Mandel House. The public was mystified, that's for certain, wrote Charles Seymour, the well-known American history professor. House's father, of Jewish origins, had come from England. His middle name was that of a Jewish merchant who was a friend of his father. His father, on arriving in America, had first been a Mexican citizen. Then he had fought to make Texas into a republic. Astutely, he had taken his pay for that collaboration in land. Later he parted company with the federal government to the north, then threw in his lot with it anew. For different flags, he laconically said. The family became very rich through the trade in cotton by sea during the somber and stormy nights of the war between the states. Arms trade and munitions made them money as well. These activities were capped by the purchase of an entire block in the city of Galveston. The son, Wilson's future manager, was raised there in an environment of gunpowder. My brother, he related, one day had half of his face blown off. He remained disfigured for the rest of his life. I don't know how I managed not to kill myself 100 times over. In school he carried a little pocket arsenal, in addition to a revolver, I had a big knife. Those weapons let me keep my comrades at a respectful distance. He spent some time in the mountains where he could do some shooting. When he was 17 years old he fell in love with another kind of fighting, political battles, and became a sort of secret agent for William Tilden, the Democratic presidential candidate in 1876. I ended up realizing that two or three senators and a like number of representatives, in concert with the president, directed the affairs of the country all by themselves. In 25 years, he would succeed in reserving the direction of the country for himself, not just sharing it with two or three senators. Was he at least a normal being? One day, he recounted, when I was soaring very high on a swing, one of the ropes broke and I fell on my head. Did it crack? In any event, the rope of the political swing did not break. His father died and left him a large fortune made during the Civil War, and House set out to conquer Texas politically. Texas in those days, as he described it, was a frontier state where the law was in the service of the individual with the keenest eye and the quickest hand, and where you died with your boots on. One day, in a bar in Colorado, a giant of a man insulted him. I grabbed my six-shooter and cocked it, but the bartender jumped over the counter and threw himself between us. 5 more seconds, and I'd have killed my man. Thus prepared, he embarked on the career which would one day make him the man who directed the thinking of America's president. House became the campaign director for a gubernatorial candidate of the Democratic Party, a man named Hogg, who was elected primarily because of House's drive. That campaign, House recalled, was a real battle. Thanks to Hogg, House was abruptly promoted from a Colorado barroom brawler to the rank of colonel. Afterwards, he would never be called anything but the colonel. Colonel of what? Of nothing. He had never passed a single hour of his life in a military barracks, but Governor Hogg had the power at that time in Texas to name anyone at all an honorary colonel. Texas grew too small for him. I'm beginning to get tired of it, he sighed. Go to the front lines. That's where you belong from now on. Hogg told him. The front was the East Coast, it was New York. His attention was drawn to the governor of New Jersey, a man named Woodrow Wilson. According to police records, he hadn't killed or robbed anyone. His speeches, very academic, were oiled with an abundance of the moral platitudes so dear to the voters, and he was said to be easily managed. Prime presidential material. Proposed house, his choice made, immediately mobilized his agents, I propped to divide the 40 Texans into 4 squads and to entrust each squad with the assault on one of the doubtful southern states. He set up propaganda centers in every city, as would nowadays be done in the launching of a new brand of detergent. On November 5, 1912, Woodrow Wilson, riding on the shoulders of Colonel House, was elected to the presidency. Wilson formed his first cabinet, and House made it a point not to accept any post. But his hand was everywhere, invisible, and quick as lightning. At the end of 1913, when Wilson sent him to see Wilhelm II, he had armed him with this simple and astonishing introduction: in the United States, he is the power behind the throne. It was Wilson himself who spelled power with a capital page. It was in that capacity that Wilhelm II was going to receive him, and it was from that time we date the first attempt of the U.S. to avert the European War. That power was going to become the supreme power not only of the United States, but, the following year, of the First World War. Without the secret but persistent intrigues of this manipulator, there would not have been any Treaty of Versailles, still less the Second World War, the poisonous mushroom spawned out of the rottenness of the preceding one. Colonel House was the key figure of 1914 to 1918. In the Europe of those years, no one even suspected House's existence, apart from a few heads of state and, in 1919, a dozen leaders of the so-called Peace Conference. Clemenceau in private would call him the super-civilized escapee from the wilds of Texas. For the world as a whole, there was only Wilson. Wilson would be received at Paris in January 1919 as the most important luminary in the world. The man who was really the most important, however, and had been since 1913, was the other one, the shadow, for whom a hotel room sufficed in Berlin, in London, or in Paris. In 1917 and 1918, in furtive silence, House would bring to the Allies, those devourers of men, 2 million fine American lads, not to mention billions of dollars and prodigious quantities of raw materials. House gained his mastery over Wilson all the more swiftly because the latter had always lived phenomenally aloof from European problems. Mr. Wilson, Colonel House quite crudely explained, had no experience with affairs of state. He added, the attitude of President Wilson with regard to the European situation bordered on indifference. That indifference was natural enough. The platform on which Wilson had made it to the presidency of the United States would have given one to believe that the world didn't exist beyond the Potomac. The Democratic platform, House noted, does not contain a single word on the subject of foreign relations or problems, except for one allusion to the Philippines. That indifference was in truth shared by nearly all of America. At the beginning of Wilson's presidency, House frankly related, there were few citizens of the United States who could claim any knowledge of European affairs of state or who had any interest in them. Intimate Papers of Colonel House, Volume 1, page 272. As for diplomats, the incoming President Wilson, who took office in 1913, was ill-served in a way scarcely possible to imagine. All the important diplomatic posts of the United States were distributed after the elections almost by auction among the electoral supporters of the new president, whatever their degree of ignorance. I am being swamped by office seekers, House moaned. Job applicants are driving me crazy. 600 employment requests for a single post. Everybody wants something. All the eccentrics in the country are at my heels. A hungry pack, he concluded. House had to pass on the candidates for federal judgeships. Two were too fat. Another had no chin. There was only one left who was presentable. I still have someone to recommend, House went on to say, patient as Job, but he has a big wart behind his ear, and I shall recommend to him that he take care not to show that side of his head. In the appointment of new ambassadors, the preceding ones, the Republicans, having been swept aside like empty food cans, the procedure was no different. The people running the party saw nothing in the post of ambassador but the means of giving an appointment to political figures whose support it was important to hang on to. House, 1, 210. Wilson had finally sent as ambassador to Berlin a judge who had got the position from House when he himself recognized that he had no chance of obtaining it on merit. As for the new American ambassador to London, he didn't know even the rudiments of the job. "That man," House tells us almost jeeringly, "asked Mr. Bryan, the Secretary of State, to be so kind as to reserve a place for him in the kindergarten so that he might learn the essentials of his job as quickly as possible." Bryan laughingly replied, "First, I'd have to learn them myself." The ambassadorial candidate for kindergarten was named Girard. When he had arrived in London, he'd had to resolve the infernal questions of dress, and was condemned to wear knee breeches to ceremonies at the court. "I find," this impromptu diplomat wrote, "that it is a laborious task taking a duchess to dinner." The Berlin staff as well had not found it easy to fit in at the imperial salons. "We Americans," Girard, the new ambassador, wrote to House, describing his first trip through Berlin in the retinue of the court, "had rather a lugubrious air in our black tails. We must have looked like a burial procession in those carriages all enclosed in glass. They were called the Black Crows there." These newly appointed diplomats had all set out aimlessly, to Berlin as to London, without having received a single line of instructions from Wilson. A short time after the appointment of Mr. Page to the embassy to the court of St. James, House recounted, "I asked Wilson if he had given the new ambassador any additional instructions. The president replied in the negative. As the British Prime Minister would one day say, they were skating on thin ice."